Okay, well, so we'll be working in chapter 13 of John, verses 1 through 30. There's about 38 verses in this chapter, but the last 8 verses we will save for the beginning of next week. Remember last week that we were working in chapter 12, Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead, and he is at the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and he is having dinner with them, and he's getting ready to enter Jerusalem. They live in a small town just a couple of miles west of Jerusalem, so he's going to walk to Jerusalem with his disciples. And it's kind of an interesting thing because this is 5 days before when he goes into Jerusalem. It's 5 days before he was arrested and crucified. He's honored. Everybody is so thrilled with his raising Lazarus from the dead. They want to see Lazarus. They've seen him. Many of them have believed on him because of that. Lazarus had been dead for 4 days when Jesus raised him. these people that believed on him caused such an uproar that the Pharisees, some of whom believed, and some of the rulers of the synagogue, some of them did believe. But they were afraid of being tossed out of the synagogue, so they were kind of quiet about it. But others had disbelief, and they were not only wanting to put Jesus to death, but they also wanted to kill Lazarus as well, simply because he was raised from the dead and he was causing such an uproar. These guys had a hard heart. Boy, they were willing to murder people left and right in order to save their position in the Jewish hierarchy. Okay, so in our study, we've seen patterns surface where a series of events are used to drive home a point. And the most prevalent in John is that which sees Jesus declaring his divinity. And he did this by teaching, not only teaching, but doing miracles. And his hearers either believed his claims or disbelieved him. There were several objects or objectives that Jesus had in mind. Number one, he wanted to make sure clear that his claims and his actions, there was no doubt that Jesus taught and demonstrated through his power that he was the Son of God. Jesus' message is clear. He wanted us to believe that he was the divine and the Messiah, as he claimed. To provide proof for the claims, John records several miracles in detail in order to support the claims of Jesus. As I mentioned, some didn't believe, but John writes as one who not only believed strongly, but he saw the proof before him which caused his belief. In John 2, verses 1 through 11, we'll remember that Jesus was invited along with his disciples to a wedding. This was the first miracle that John recorded. Now, in John chapter 20 also, which will be in the future, John also makes mention that there were many miracles that Jesus did that are not recorded in this book. And most of them were done to enforce the belief of the disciples that were following Jesus. But they weren't recorded in the book of John, but we do have seven miracles that were recorded. The first one is in John 2, it's about water into wine. If you remember that Jesus was invited to a wedding, his mother was there. They ran out of wine in the celebration, and Jesus' mother came to him and said, "We're out of wine. Can you, do your thing and make some more wine?" And which is what Jesus did. It was kind of interesting because he told some guys to fill up some water jugs. They held about 20 to 30 gallons apiece. He asked them to fill up the jugs with water, which they did. And they served the wine, and the comment was, one of the hosts said, well, to the wedding host said, "Hey, you know, we usually serve the best wine first. And that way, when we run out and everybody is halfway snockered, then we can give them the lousy wine and they won't know any difference." But in this particular case, he said, "You know, you served the bad wine first, and now you've come up with the best wine." So it was just an example of God's power and through Jesus as to one of the things that he did. Number two, if you'll remember, he had an official come to him. This was in John 4. This government official came to him and said, had heard about Lazarus being raised from the dead. And he came and he said, "Master," he said, "my son is sick unto death." He said, I need your help. Would you heal him?" And Jesus said, he's well. He's taken care of. Your son is alive." Well, the guy went back. The official went back. And as he was going back home, some of his servants came and said, "Your son is alive and well." And the servant asked the official asked his servant, "What time did he get well?" And they said, "About the seventh hour yesterday." And this official knew what time that Jesus had told him and realized what Jesus has done for him by healing his son long distance. And he and his household believed. In John 5, we see about the healing of the cripple by the pool. I never have quite figured out exactly how this works. But apparently there was an angel that came down and stirred the water at a certain time in this pool. And what happened was all the poor people that had infirmities, this particular man was crippled from birth, laid by the pool, and the first one to get into the pool got healed. I never have quite understood exactly how this happened. So I've kind of avoided talking about it a little bit because I haven't figured it out. But apparently this is what happened with this pool. And this poor guy was crippled from birth. He couldn't get to the pool. He said, Jesus came along and said, "You want to be healed?" And he said, "Well, I can't make it to the water. Somebody always beats me to it." And so Jesus said, "Pick up your mat and walk." And he did that very thing, that very distinct time. And of course, this raised a lot of stink amongst the Pharisees and the rulers of the synagogue. Then we find in John chapter 6 about Jesus feeding the 5,000 with couple of little fish and some baby loaves, and there was all kinds of food left over afterwards. And of course, that's 5,000 men. Now, I'm sure that there were as many or more women and children that were had come along as well. So you can imagine what happened with two little fish and a couple of loaves of bread. Just wouldn't have gone very far. So, and then later on, after Jesus left that, in John 6, we find that Jesus walked on water and met his disciples who were getting across to the other side, and they didn't know where Jesus was. And all of a sudden, he shows up walking on the water. And this was another miracle of force, of course. If you remember in John 9, about Jesus healing the blind man, and he spit on the ground and mixed a little dirt with the spittle and put it on the man's eyes, and he told him to go wash. And he went and washed in the pool and became able to see. And of course, this raised all kinds of trouble as well. And then we have Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and we talked about that a little bit. But all these things were used to enforce Jesus' claims that he was sent from God, was God's son, as he claimed. And he did these miracles for a reinforcement for those things. And these, as I said, John 20 tells us that he did a lot more miracles for them, but they didn't record it. To record the reaction of the people, Jesus showed that the disbelief was widespread amongst the Jews, and it wasn't a fluke or a narrow opinion. John describes a familiar scene of Jesus showing great power, and the leaders, and soon the crowds that had a short time before honored him, turned against him in anger and disbelief. If you recall, just the 5 days as before that Jesus came in to Jerusalem, they provided a donkey for him. They threw palm leaves down for him to walk on. They were honoring him. And, of course, this raised Cain with the ruling class of Jews. When he was claiming outright that he was divine, and that he was the Son of God, and he was there to save them from their sins. Of course, they turned against him in anger and disbelief, and 5 days later, they were ready to hang him on a cross. So it kind of shows us how soon things can change in the crowds. You see it today. One time you got somebody that's honored, and the next week they're down in the dumps. And opinion has turned against them, and they're ready to tear people apart. Same way here with Jesus. He was about ready to be torn apart 5 days later. Absolutely amazing what kind of change, especially in light of the number of miracles he did in front of them. They couldn't very well deny that, and yet the political parties that were in control, they kept pushing this disbelief, and after a while, everybody started believing it, and they were gonna hang him on a tree. And of course, Isaiah tells us in several instances about this disbelief, and that their hearts were hardened, and Jesus himself says that he's going to be put on high. In other words, he was going to be hanged on a tree. And they couldn't, the disciples couldn't quite understand this at the time, but afterwards they remembered what he had said. This brings us, compared the reaction of people to Lazarus' death and his resurrection, and we learned how different people had their strength, their faith strengthened by this miracle, and how others, like the religious leaders, hardened their hearts in disbelief and repeated the cycle of faith and rejection one more time. In this chapter 13, John begins a narrative that will describe the final hours of Jesus' ministry here on earth and how people reacted to him with or without faith. Each year, the Jews celebrated the Feast of the Passover that commemorated the liberation of the Israelites from Egyptian bondage. The feast focused on the final power, powerful sign that God used in freeing them. The Jews were to kill a lamb, sprinkle the blood on the doorposts and the mantles, and eat the Passover meal indoors. The next day, the Jews were set free and were instructed to observe the Passover every year as a remembrance to God's power and grace. Going back to Exodus, about the Passover, and you remember the 10 plagues. The 10th plague was firstborn of every human being that lived in Egypt, and the firstborn of every animal as well, cattle, whatever, was to die unless there was a blood sample put on the doorpost over the house. And this, of course, is what they did. And the Pharaoh himself, even though his heart had been hardened 9 times before, on the 10th, it was just a little bit too much for him. He lost his eldest son and the heir to the throne. So he finally had had enough and released the children of Israel. We all know that story. We've studied it many times. And but the Jews, after this, the Israelites, they were called back in those days, were told to observe this religious holiday every year. And this was coming up with Jesus being in Jerusalem. The Passover was ready to go, and Jesus was there to observe the Passover. Now, before the Passover, this gives us in chapter 13, it says, now before the Passover, this gives us kind of a timeline that we can reference pretty accurately. It was a Thursday evening. They were in an upper room. Jesus with his disciples was there for a private meal, and as they were coming into this upper room, they were arguing about who was the most important person, and it's absolutely amazing to me that these people going in the room with Jesus, they're arguing which one has the most honor, which one is the most important. And Jesus remembered this conversation. He heard them, and he's going to show them the answer. And it's an answer that none of them could not understand. And Jesus was fully aware of who he was and why he had been sent. And he knew that his time was near, and he knew what kind of men his disciples were. And knowing and accepting this, he still and their faults, he still loved them and accepted what he was sent to do on their behalf. And even knowing that one of his disciples would betray him, he still loved them and humbled himself to do the thing that he was about to do. In those days, there weren't any paved highways or anything like that. Maybe some rocks along some pathways that were important, but as a rule, they were dirt pathways that you walked on, or what they would call highways back in those days, that were important trails to walk. But they were dirt, and of course the type of shoes that they wore when they walked was your feet got dirty. And so as a rule of courtesy, at the end of a journey, when someone came into someone's house, they would usually have someone there. They would have some water set aside to wash the feet. And when they did that, it was usually relegated. This chore was relegated to someone of least importance in the household, maybe a slave or a servant of the lowest order, or maybe the youngest son of the household. But it was an act of courtesy and humbleness. Jesus rose from the meal while they were eating this Passover meal, and he took off his clothes and he girded himself with a towel, and he proceeded to wash the apostles' feet. Apparently it wasn't done when they came in, and so this was probably deliberately done, but Jesus got up and humbled himself and proceeded to wash the apostles' feet. Can you imagine that? The chagrin when the Lord himself begins to go around and quietly wash the apostles' feet and do them the honor. How humble can this be? The work of a slave. I'm not sure that the disciples at this particular time liked the seating arrangement that they had, and they had been arguing amongst themselves about their importance. So Jesus here is giving them a distinct lesson in humbleness. And I think probably it's just my idea of what I read, but I think that Judas was probably sitting next to Jesus. And he was probably the first, or at least the second person that Jesus humbled himself and washed his feet. Goes to show you that, and the reason I say that is because later on we'll find that Jesus dipped a morsel of bread and handed it to Judas. So I know that he was close. But Jesus knew that God had given him all things into his hands. This wasn't something new. Several years before in his ministry, Jesus refers to God giving everything into his hands. We find that in John 3, verse 35. Jesus was about to face the agony of the cross, and not as a victim, but as a victor. And he could have refused to do so had he wanted. God had given everything into his hands. And so Jesus was not forced to do this, so he went as a willing sacrifice for us. And but he wanted to give the disciples a lesson. and he was about to lower himself by washing their feet. The gospel accounts often don't tell us the motive or the thinking behind what Jesus did, but this is different. John tells us exactly why Jesus washed their feet and spoke to them with so much love in the following chapters. John may have asked Jesus why he did it, and perhaps Jesus told him. Let's go to chapter 13 and verse 6 through 11. Is there someone that would like to read that for us? John chapter 13, verses 6 through 11. Peter breaks the awkward silence with a show of protest. He says, "Well, not only wash my feet, Lord, but wash my hands and my head." Jesus said to be completely clean, all you need is to have your feet washed. Let's read verses 12 through 17. Somebody want to volunteer for that?
So after he had washed their feet, he had taken his garments and was set down. And again, he said unto them, "Know ye what I have done to you? Call me Master, Lord, and ye shall ye say well, for so I am. If then your Lord and Master have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is no greater than his Lord. Neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are ye if ye do them." Okay. I speak. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay.
Thank you, Frank. Jesus uses the example of foot washing as a lesson on how they should base their attitude for one another. If the Lord can do it to you, then you could certainly do it to one another. In verses 18 through 20, I'll go ahead and read that, and it says, if I can find it, there it is. "I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones I have chosen. But it is that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me. From now on I am telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me." Jesus here hints that there's one who will betray him, one who had his feet washed by Jesus, but whose heart is unclean. Jesus not only tells them about this betrayal, but he tells them it was prophesied by David 1,000 years before. We find that in Psalms 41. Jesus is telling them, I'm telling you this before it happens, so you will understand who I am a little bit more firmly. My nature is divine, and I want you to understand that even more fully. And so I'm telling you this prophecy that David made 1,000 years before is coming true. And of course, he was speaking about Judas. As I say, Judas must have been sitting next to Jesus, or at least very close, because Jesus had dipped his bread in the wine and the bitters and gave them to Judas. He said that he was the person I give, and dip a morsel in and give it to him, is the one that's going to betray me. And that for some reason the disciples missed this. They missed the importance of the gesture, and we'll find Jesus saying to Judas, what you need to do quickly. And Judas immediately gets up and leaves to go do his deed. Okay, we'll stop here because the next discussion will begin with Jesus' last prayer. But let's take two things with us today. A servant is not above his master. If we choose to follow Jesus, we must follow him in all his ways, not just some. If he was willing to wash our feet before the communion, so must we be willing to do this to humble ourselves as well. If we don't, we don't belong at the Lord's table. Two, a servant should examine himself or herself. If Judas would have examined his heart full of disbelief and greed, he might not have fallen under the total control of Satan. When the Lord hands us the communion bread, let's make sure it's not an accusation of infidelity and hypocrisy, like the morsel of bread that he handed Judas. We need to make sure our hearts are right before we sit and eat with the Lord, and we're not sitting in Judas' seat. He was in a position of honor before men, but Jesus knew his heart. It won't be long before we'll have an opportunity to sit at the Lord's table and to remember those things that Jesus set up for us, that we can have the honor of sitting before him. And we need to examine ourselves. We do this every Sunday morning to honor Jesus. And yet, I feel anyway, personally, sometimes that I sort of take it for granted. I don't think about how important it is and how critical it is. And that's just a weakness that I think most of us have, that we have done this so often that we just kind of have set aside how critical and how important this is and what an honor it is to sit before the Lord's table. And I appreciate you sharing your time with me. And Ted will be with us next week. And Dean is out of town, and so he asked me last week if I would cover for him today. I appreciate your time and the opportunity of sharing some of the things with you that I've studied. Next week, chapters 1331 to 1431. If you'd like to study ahead, that would be great.